Well, that music, Mr. Miller, could certainly take us into some things Russian, but I think that I've kind of dwelled too much on things I perceive to be grave situations. And when you talk about Russia, well, it's hard to find a lot of sunny optimism there. I guess I should note for the listenership that my views on this somewhat dark are not always shared by Mr. McMillan, who has a somewhat sunnier view of these matters, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say that your glass is sort of half empty and my glass is full of scotch.
Would that be single malt?
A good single malt, yes.
Okay.
That way, if things go south, I still have a full glass of scotch.
Well, all right then. So I guess all I will say about Russia for today's program is that Vladimir Putin was, quote, reelected, unquote. Of course, that is a relatively easy thing to accomplish when you have no meaningful political opposition. And although we have a few more grim topics that I'd like to address before we quit today, I think we need to take a little detour into just, you know, the sunshine. And what better way to do that than with our perennial favorite, the good, the bad, and the ugly. According to the Week magazine, it was a good week last week for, I guess you'd say, that old phrase, crime doesn't pay. The story is that 18,500 bobblehead dolls of retired hockey star Jaromir Jagr was stolen en route to a Pittsburgh Penguins promotional night, prompting an FBI spokesman to wonder out loud, who's going to try and move 18,500 bobbleheads on the black market? Was, on the other hand, a bad week last week for public safety with the news that Republicans in New Hampshire's House of Representatives voted to remove restrictions on brass knuckles, blackjack clubs, and slungshots, which apparently are weights attached to swingable cords. Sponsors of the bill say those non-lethal forms of self-defense should be as legal as knives and guns. Democratic Representative David Muse said there's no need for more weapons that would make our streets, our gathering places, and our schools any more dangerous. Of course, I've always taken the position that when brass knuckles are outlawed, only outlaws will have brass knuckles. And lastly, it was an ugly week last week for, I guess you'd say, geoengineering, with the news that Salisbury, Massachusetts residents shelled out $565,000 to truck 14,000 tons of sand to protect their beachfront homes from an advancing sea, only to see it all washed away in 72 hours. Resident Ron Guilmette was quoted as saying, I don't know what the solution is. Well, I'd say, you've certainly proven that. I was watching a documentary the other day on a beachfront town in Oregon that no longer exists, but was quite popular back in the early 1900s. It's all a wilderness now, and what struck me was the main blow that the resorts apparently suffered was putting in one jetty. Although some thought two jetties might be more effective at preventing wave erosion, they could only afford one, I guess, put one in, and then the waves came crashing in and destroyed the island. You know, I think you have to spend more time on this hydraulic engineering stuff. And speaking of engineering, we have some follow-up on something we mentioned a while back, which was bots, dots. Mr. Miller decided to look up on Snopes whether, well, for starters, the Bots Dots were named after their inventor, and Snopes gave that one the green light. Bots Dots are named for their inventor, Elbert Bots, a chemist who worked for Caltrans in the 1950s as chief of the Highway Pavement Division. Bots Dots came up a few weeks back when yours truly was reporting on driving back from Southern California and finding that in really lousy weather, on some marginal roads, you had a hard time seeing the lanes, and this was made much worse by the fact that the Bots Dots were no longer there. And according to Wikipedia, my speculation that these things are being taken out because, well, they're going to make the roadways more compatible with self-driving cars, I think is the major motivator in this change. In 2017, Caltrans announced it would stop using BOTS/DOTS as the sole indicator of lane division due to cost and worker safety. Which, you know, sounds like BS to me. Maybe the qualifier is as the sole indicator of lane division, because, you know, you still want stripes, don't you? And doggone it, we sometimes get desperate in our search for good news, but I've got one item here that I'm pretty sure qualifies. According to the BBC, there are now more giant redwoods in the forests of Britain than in the species' native California. Redwoods were first brought to the UK about 160 years ago by Victorians who wanted exotic trees for their grand estates. British redwoods now number 500,000. California, by contrast, has just 80,000 mature redwood trees left. So far, the UK transplants aren't nearly as big, of course, reaching just 180 feet, compared with over 300 for the oldest California versions. But scientists say that's only because they haven't had as long to grow.
Sounds like BBS to me.
No, now come on. It's got to be a great climate in the UK to have redwoods. They need it to be moist and cool. And it's that. Researchers are adding that because redwoods in California are increasingly threatened by drought and wildfires, these species may actually end up faring better in its new home. Let's hope that do-gooders over in Britain don't start cutting them down as invasive species like people are doing with eucalyptus here in California. And here's a little item from The Economist magazine that surprises me. Apparently, in February of 2004, a Ben Hammersley, British journalist, noticed that there was a new kind of digital media out there, downloadable radio, produced by geeky amateurs or public broadcasters. Mr. Hammersley suggested a few names for it. Fortunately, audio blogging and guerrilla media did not catch on, but a third did, podcasting, a portmanteau of iPod and broadcasting. And of course, Radio Parallax is a podcast which you can listen to and perhaps are doing so now at radioparallax.com. We do encourage you, and haven't done so lately, but should do so again, that, you know, drop us a line if you feel like it at info@radioparallax.com. And to the query from the listenership about small nuclear reactors, I'm still working on that one. We've had so many shows dealing with nuclear power, I don't frankly remember which one that was, but I'll try and give you a hand. And of course, if you're going to have a podcast, you're going to need, well, basically a power grid and a communication system, which leads us to a fascinating article in The New Yorker from the March 4th edition, piece by Catherine Schultz titled Starburst. The subheadline is, "The next big solar storm could devastate our power grid and communication systems. Are we prepared?" And I'll just telegraph the answer to that last question right away. Basically, no. The article starts out by talking to a man named Ken Tegnell, who studies the sun. He first started doing this for the Air Force because, well, it was important to see what the sun was doing as regards to radio communication. When the sun misbehaves, it can raise hell with our radio communications here on Earth, and worse. Unlike some of the writing of Catherine Schultz, she said regular Earth-based weather is such a fundamental part of our lives that we are almost always aware of it and very often obsessed with it. Such the subject of everything from idle chit-chat to impassioned political debate. By contrast, most people have no idea there is weather in outer space, let alone what its fluctuations might mean for our planet. That's because unlike everyday weather, you can't experience space weather directly. It doesn't make you hot or cold, doesn't flood your basement, or take the roof off your home. In fact, until the 19th century, it had almost no appreciable effect whatsoever on human activity. And then scientists and technologists and business people started using electricity. In the mid-1800s, telegraphs became an excellent way to achieve long-distance communication. They certainly improved upon things like flashing mirrors and smoke signals. And notes the piece, the first solar storm to cause trouble for us humans took place in 1859. In late August, the Aurora Borealis, which is normally visible only in polar latitudes, made a series of unusual appearances in Havana, Panama, Rome. And then in early September, the aurora returned with such brilliance that gold miners in the Rocky Mountains woke up at night and began making breakfast. Disoriented birds greeted the non-existent morning. This lovely yet perplexing phenomenon, notes the author, had an unwelcome corollary. Around the globe, telegraph systems went haywire. Many stopped working entirely, but others sent and received fantastical and unreadable messages. At some telegraph stations, operators found they could disconnect their batteries and send messages via the ambient current, as if the Earth itself had become an instant messaging system. Owing to a lucky coincidence, all these anomalies were soon linked to their likely cause. Because at around noon, on September 1st, the British astronomer Richard Carrington was outside sketching a group of sunspots when he saw a burst of light on the sun. This was the first known observation of a solar flare. It was followed by accounts of low-latitude auroras yet again, and reports that magnetometers, devices that measure fluctuations in the Earth's magnetic field, had surged so high they maxed out their recording capabilities. Now, we've talked about this on the show before. One thing we hadn't talked about, which I didn't know, was that there were some other near-Carrington-like events that have taken place in the meantime. In May of 1921, for example, dazzling lights filled the night sky in places as far from the poles as Texas and Samoa. And on this occasion also, spectacle was accompanied by debacle. Electrical sparks leaping from a telegraph switchboard set on fire a railroad station in Brewster, New York, while stray voltage on railway signals and switching systems halted trains in Manhattan. Much more alarming, in May of 1967, all three radar sites of the ballistic missile early warning systems, then maintained by the U.S. Air Force, appeared to have been jammed. Word that the Soviet Union was on the verge of attacking, military officials nearly scrambled nuclear-equipped aircraft. 5 years later, during the Vietnam War, the United States started sowing the waters around North Vietnamese seaports with mines that had magnetic sensors. These were to trigger explosions when steel-hulled vessels passed overhead. 3 months after that program began, many of those mines, 4,000 of them, according to one contemporaneous source, detonated almost simultaneously. Investigation determined that the plant had been compromised not by Hanoi, but by a newly discovered solar phenomenon called a coronal mass injection. The article tries to get into the physics of all this a little bit and explains that, you know, the sun, unlike the Earth, rotates at different speeds. If you're standing on the surface of the Earth, you're going to do a full turn in 24 hours. If you're standing on the surface of the sun, which we don't recommend, by the way, you will move slower at the poles than you do at the equator, which causes all sorts of strange things in the magnetic fields. And these lead to sunspots and two very important solar phenomena you need to understand, which are the aforementioned solar flares, like the Carrington event, and the coronal mass ejections, like the Hanoi event, both of which stem from the same thing, a buildup of energy in the magnetic field of the sun. Now, when you get a solar flare, you have a bright spot on the surface of the sun, if you happen to be projecting it onto a wall, looking at it through filters. The energy from a solar flare crosses the electromagnetic spectrum from gamma rays to X-rays to radio waves and, in the middle, visible light. Solar flares contain a colossal amount of energy, notes the article, enough, in a large one, to meet our planet's power needs for the next 15 to 20,000 years. The second is the coronal mass ejection, a billion-ton bubble of magnetized plasma that explodes off the surface of the sun. The two phenomena can occur separately, but when they occur together, and they're large, they mark the beginning of a major solar storm. Anyway, these solar storms can, as we say, mess up radio communications and can generate currents, and that's where this gets to be a bit of a problem. These things can heat up the atmosphere of the Earth and make it slightly larger, and which increases the drag on satellites. They can fry satellites directly. And they can cause a malfunctioning of the global positioning system, which it turns out has more consequences than this, you know, maybe having you miss the on-ramp while you're driving on the highway. GPS also carries multiple atomic clocks, normally accurate to within a billionth of a second, which transmit hyper-acute temporal information, known as GPS timing signals. Those signals are one of our most essential pieces of invisible infrastructure. Cell phone companies use them to manage the flow of data all over their networks. I didn't really realize this, but GPS is a service that our federal government provides free of charge. Since it's not a perfect system. Backups have been advised for increasing flying safety, but that costs extra money. And then there's the matter of our largely unregulated satellite industry. Some of these space weather experts note in the article that it's a wild west out there. Expert Bill Murtaugh was quoted as saying, "I do not think they're ready for a major space weather event." And when you generate currents in wires, which turns out to be direct current, and our power grid relies upon transmitting AC current, well, bad things happen to transformers. I didn't realize this, but transformers are pretty much made specifically for their needs in every instance. In other words, you can't just crank out a bunch of them and store them. So when we get another large event like a Carrington event, it's likely to blow out power grids all over the world. And it won't be a matter of weeks or months to get the power grid back up. In some cases, it will be a matter of years. Anyway, in summary, this is trouble brewing. We don't necessarily want to suggest that you go out and buy a generator.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm thinking about it. And for more information, please check out the article, Catherine Schultz, New Yorker, March 4th edition. At the top of the show, we mentioned pulling out some articles from our archives, and one of them that really especially struck me was a 22-pager, which came out of Harper's. It was in their September 04 issue. I printed my copy up in July of 07 and talked about it on the show, I think in conjunction with the fact that Lewis Lapham, the author, was appearing locally. And yes, we did pitch to Lewis Lapham about coming on this radio program and secured his phone number. And I realized later that I really didn't know how to conduct an interview with Lewis H. Lapham. But then again, Mr. Lapham still is alive at age 89, and maybe I should reconsider. The article in question, by the way, is titled Tentacles of Rage, The Republican Propaganda Mill, A Brief History. And I think this is essential reading for someone who wants to understand what's going on our political scene here in the U.S. of A. Lapham outlined how it was that back in the 1970s, conservatives, which lacked, intellectual credentials, decided to start funding think tanks and producing folks who would espouse viewpoints more to their liking. Lapham describes a steady flow of newsletters from more than 100 captive printing presses, among those at the Heritage Foundation, Accuracy in the Media, the American Enterprise Institute, and the Center for Popular Culture, among others. This rather dark money provided generous distributions of academic programs and visiting professorships to places like Harvard, Yale, and Stanford, and also passing along soundbite slanders to the likes of Bill O'Reilly and Matt Drudge. To quote Lapham, "The prolonged siege of words has proved so successful in its result that on nearly every question of foreign or domestic policy in this year's presidential campaign, the frame and terms of the debate might as well have been assembled in Taiwan by Chinese child labor working from patterns furnished by the authors of ExxonMobil's annual report." Anyway, this swing to the right in America dates back to the 1970s. Among other things, the Republican Party saw an opportunity to become the anti-civil rights party. Shoes they were able to enthusiastically step into. But I think the point of all this is that our current dismal state of politics in this country is not, you know, something you can lay at the foot of Donald Trump. Well, up to a degree you can, but it's a much bigger thing going on. I had a long talk with one of our regular contributors a few days ago and was discussing the issue of the fact that Trump doesn't really have all that much money on his own. He ran a campaign that was very underfunded against Hillary Clinton in 2016, still managed to win. He does have powerful financial backers and will not be elected president in 2024 without them. And the question is, what do they see in Donald Trump? Why do they want to back Donald Trump? Well, in our last segment, we explored a little bit about why it was Silicon Valley might like the second Trump administration. It goes without saying that, you know, wealthy industrialists are on board. Wall Street's on board, and they've cross-pollinated with the Christian fundamentalists. It's worth taking a look at the enablers. And to discuss enablers, I'm going to jump from 2024 to 1932. Talk about another guy who we think of as grabbing power, but really didn't so much grab it as was handed it. To do this, I'm going to cite an article from The New Yorker, the March 25th issue, by Adam Gopnik with that title, The Enablers. The article is largely a book review by Timothy R. Ryback's new book, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. Said Gopnik, Ryback details week by week, day by day, and sometimes hour by hour how a country with a functional, if flawed, democratic machinery handed absolute power over to someone who could never claim a majority in an actual election, and whom the entire conservative political class regarded as a chaotic clown with a violent following. Says Gopnik, Ryback shows how major players thought they could find some ulterior advantage in managing him. Each was sure that after the passing of a brief storm cloud, they would emerge in possession of power. The corporate bosses thought that if you looked past the strutting and the performative anti-Semitism, you had someone who would protect your money. Communist ideologues thought that if you peered deeply enough into the strutting and performative anti-Semitism, you could spy the pattern of a popular revolution. The decent right thought that he was too obviously deranged to remain in power long. And the decent left, tempered by earlier fights against different enemies, thought that if they forcibly stuck to the rule of law, then the law would somehow by itself entrap a lawless leader. Said Gopnik, in a now familiar paradox, the rational forces stuck to magical thinking, while the irrational ones were more logical, parsing the brute equations of power. And so the storm never passed. In a way, it still has not. The most interesting part of this article for me, I think, was the story of General Kurt von Schleicher. Described as a classic Prussian militarist, like so many of the German upper class, he was also a cultivated and cosmopolitan bon vivant, whom the well-connected journalist and diarist Bella Frohm called a man of almost irresistible charm. Schleicher had no illusions about Hitler. "What am I to do with that psychopath?" he said after hearing about his behavior. But infinitely ambitious, he thought that Hitler's call for strongman rule might awaken the German people to the need for a real strongman, i.e., General Schleicher. I guess for me, the fascinating thread in all of this was the description of how it was in November of 1932, after yet another Reichstag election, and how, once again, Hitler and Goebbels were unable to obtain an electoral majority. It would turn out that Hitler, in fact, was not finished. General Schleicher conspired with Chancellor Hindenburg to have Franz von Papen fired as German Chancellor and replaced by him. He calculated that he could cleave Gregor Strasser, who was one of the more leftist members of the Nazi Party, considered one of its more respectable elements. He could cleave him away from Hitler and form a coalition with them and leave Hitler on the outside looking in. But Papen, described as a small man in everything except his taste for revenge, turned on Schleicher in a rage and went directly to Hitler, proposing, despite his earlier never-Hitler views, that they form their own coalition. Hitler then denounced Strasser. Schleicher realized he was not able to form his coalition. He was fired as chancellor, and the door was then opened for Hitler to become the next chancellor of Germany. The Nazis never looked back once they gained power, and the people that Hitler saw as standing in his way, like Schleicher and Strasser and Ernst Röhm of the SA, were murdered. Here's one sidelight I did not realize. Von Papen, who had ushered Hitler directly into power, was acquitted at Nuremberg in the 1950s and was later awarded the highest honorary order of the Catholic Church. Isn't that heartwarming? Well, I think it's pretty clear we don't want to wind up like Germany did back in the 1930s, and what are we going to do about it? That's something we need to devote some shows to. What can we do about this in a practical sense? And one thing I would urge the Democrats to do was to get off their asses and start fighting fire with fire. I'd like to cite an article from The Guardian titled, "The Man Who Tricked Nazi Germany, Lessons from the Past on How to Beat Disinformation." Turns out the Nazis were masters of disinformation, kind of like Steve Bannon. But a man named Sefton Delmar managed to beat them at their own game. Delmar wanted to alienate people from the Nazi propaganda by pushing Nazi propaganda one step further into the ridiculous. And you know what? That's something the Democrats need to be doing right now. It's not enough that we have The Daily Show and Bill Maher and John Oliver out there. The Democrats need to put some money into this. I believe it should be very easy to hoist Trump and company by their own petard, which, by the way, translates from Shakespearean English into blow them up with their own bomb. The Democrats need to talk about things like what's going to happen next in the abortion battle, which is a subject for another show. But suffice it to say that the Dobbs decision was just the opening round. The Supreme Court is considering the case FDA versus Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, which is trying very hard to completely overrule medicine and get the drug mifepristone rendered much less available to the public, which is going to be a very, very bad thing if that goes through. We have about a minute or two left, so we should throw out one final item, I think, which is about Trump's obvious signs of dementia. Writing in The Bulwark, Bill Luters said, "Neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump has managed to avoid the encroachment of age. But while Biden's decline is typical of people around 80, forgetting names, memory lapses, and arthritic gait, numerous psychiatrists say Trump is showing signs of major cognitive decline and thought disorder. Trump not only keeps saying that Barack Obama's president, he also shows the telltale signs of dementia-related aphasia, the inability to recall and speak common words. At a recent rally, Trump tried to say Venezuela, and it came out Venezuela. In another speech, Trump struggled to say 3 years later, that became 3 years lady. And when Trump struggled to correct himself, he couldn't pronounce later, saying lady, lady. His words are often slurred, and his syntax is increasingly mangled and childish. Compare the vigorous and coherent Biden at his recent State of the Union address with Trump clinging to the podium at his rallies, mangling words, babbling, and trailing off in mid-sentence. Only one of them is clearly mentally unfit to be president. And alas, we have no time to deal with his purported bad smell. We'll get to it one day. This program was produced by Edward McMillan, who doesn't smell all that bad. Yay! I'm Douglas Everett. This is Radio Parallax. We'll see you again, I think, in 2 weeks.